Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Andrew Colin. Andrew is professor of political science at Hilbert College. He's written a number of books. They include State Power and Democracy and State Structure and Genocide. Andrew is also a valued contributor to the forthcoming book I was asked to serve as editor of, titled, I mentioned it before on the program, I hope it'll be a major contribution to understanding what's going on in Ukraine. It's titled Flashpoint in Ukraine, U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risk World War III. And Andrew already contributed a chapter. It's titled, let me pull it up, Ukraine from Coup to Police State. Oh, indeed so. It's all that and more. A very, very ugly situation and a valued contribution from Andrew. Others, distinguished contributors like him, contributing their own chapters. And hopefully the book will be up before too very long. It takes a while to put a book together. It's not a simple proposition. It's a little easier than planning a war, but there's a lot of work that goes into producing a book. Besides the writing of it, you know, the editing, editing by the publisher, the typesetting, the distribution, the printing, the whole works. It's a major job. I'm glad I'm not involved in the latter part of it, but I am involved a little bit in formatting the material to send to my editor at Clarity Press, and then she'll take over and do her job and move the ball forward to getting the book out. She does it one book after another. A couple of mine she did it for. She's marvelous to work with. My great thanks to her. Andrew, welcome to the program. So much going on. We sure want to talk about Ukraine and anything else that you may have in your mind. I'll mention one thing before I turn you loose. I mentioned in an email to you a few days ago, I've written so many articles on Ukraine, but I began running out of topics. Well, I came up with one today, and I drafted an article. I'll finish it later after the program. I call it Madness in Ukraine. The idea of using Ukraine as a global flashpoint that literally could possibly incite a global conflict. If that isn't madness, I don't know what is, Andrew. And that's part of what's going on. And I quote from another analyst who operates out of India making similar comments, and I threw in an awful lot of my own. Andrew, I'm very eager to hear what you have to say today.
Once again, thank you for inviting me back to be on your program.
My honor, Andrew.
Sure. I'd like to start off by saying, you know, what I really like being on your program is that unlike the corporate media, which barely covers foreign policy, we have the opportunity on your program, given the hour that we have, it's possible to discuss the significance of global events and how they affect U.S. domestic policy, which is something I do want to touch upon and take it into another area, which I initially hadn't given any consideration and written about in my article, but as I had time to think about how my preparation for today's program, I thought also we could not only talk about U.S.-Russia in terms of the crisis of Ukraine, but tie it together to the extremely troubling issue of climate change, which I feel it does fit into that. But I would like to start off by, again, briefly, very briefly, as best I can, starting with the official, what I call corporate media position on what they see as going on in Ukraine and get beneath that, go beneath the surface and really get critical as to what's really going on. Now, I'm sure as your listeners are well aware of the standard media overview is that there is on the one hand the social forces of democracy, and on the other hand those social forces which appear to oppose democracy and support authoritarianism. The picture is far more complicated than that, and certainly this is an incredibly distorted view of events in the Ukraine. Now, if you look at supposedly these so-called of forces in support of democracy, which ousted the former president. If you look at what was going on prior to his ouster in the streets of Kiev, there was really little interest in what I would call stereotype democracy. If you look at these so-called pro-democracy forces, they were a combination of far-right nationalists and out-and-out fascists who staged the attacks on the government buildings. Look at, for instance, one of the leading participants, the ultra-right Svoboda, if I pronounce that right, or Freedom Party. And if you look at one of the leading members of the Svoboda Council, that is Yuri Noviev, he said the goal of the movement, simply put, is to break ties with Russia. And what we found, certainly others like myself who looked into the matter, is that the far right has established ties with certain members of the U.S. government, members of Congress. But to go on with what the Sobota was saying, they want to establish simply closer ties with the EU and the United States, and this will take my discussion a bit later to talk about the politics of gas and oil and climate change. But if you right away look at these street criminals, I call them, these fascists, already got into various positions in the government. But there's more to that besides the appointment of them in key positions, and the appointment of them is as now 36 deputies in the Ukrainian parliament. If you start to trace back, and again, I want to cover this very briefly, if you look at these far-right and semi-fascist parties in the streets, you could trace them back to World War II, the Ukrainian nationalists who fought for the Nazis. And there was the formation of the Ukrainian National Army, which became part of the 14th Grenadier Division of the Waffen-SS, known as the Galicia Division, which, by the way, they were responsible for the murder of 800,000 Jews in the Ukraine. So hardly a, how do you say, very good history. But there's more to the right and the U.S. support. Again, this was a leaked conversation of a phone call between U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs Victoria Nuland and U.S. Ambassador to the Ukraine Jeffrey Piot. And Nuland refers to Yat, that's Y-A-T, his nickname, to be the new head of the government. Now, Yat is a abbreviation for Yatna Yuk, if I pronounce it, of the Fatherland Party. And Yatna Yuk is now the acting prime minister. Now, again, what we have then is clearly this kind of support being given to the right and seeking to put them in power. John McCain, he was present at many of their rallies and supports the Sobota, and he's not the only one. Certainly other members of Congress were pledging their support. But what I want to get beyond the right wing in the streets and talk about the economics and start to tie it into the politics of oil and global climate change, let's start to talk about the role of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the EU, who are trying to reshape the Ukrainian economy more along capitalist lines, which has already begun to be taking place starting in 2004. Now, what they are proposing is that they'll bail out the Ukraine, providing they put in place what they call, quote-unquote, severe austerity measures. Now, this was the point in time when the former president broke talks with the EU and began to negotiate with Russia and to get loans from Russia. And as I'm sure your listeners are well aware of, then you get the November demonstrations. Now, again, let me get back to the EU and the IMF deals. They were proposing a paltry $160 million per year for 5 years. But again, all these loans and even the larger ones from the IMF are in exchange for a massive privatization of the economy. And this has been the effort, by and large, of the United States and the EU going back to the 1990s. Now, there is another association which, of course, is not discussed at all by the corporate media. And that is kind of, I can say, kind of typical if you look at the history of U.S. foreign policy, going as far back as one would like. But look at the role of the military in support of the privatization of the Ukrainian economy. And what has been happening since the 1990s, the U.S. and NATO have encroached, expanding NATO closer and closer to the border of Russia. Now, if you look at this encroachment, the NATO forces have more or less been, since the 90s, militarily surrounding Russia. Now NATO allies and affiliates include Croatia, Estonia, Latvia, Litvia, Slovakia, Albania, the Czech Republic, Poland, and Romania. Now, again, if you look at the continuing crisis, what are we seeing? I say this with great regret, in spite of what we have heard, the distorted version from the corporate media. It's not the return of the Cold War. It is the ongoing crisis of the Cold War, which was never really over. Consider that Putin is typically being denounced in Cold War language as a Hitler. This is according to Hillary Clinton. A stone-cold Hitler, Putin is characterized according to Robert Gates. Now, one must not forget, turning again our attention to history, that Russia's had an ongoing and understanding obsession with secure borders, given especially the all-too-recent Nazi invasion. And again, they are feeling threatened by this NATO encroachment in and around its borders. But again, if you step back to the 90s and now fast forward to the present, we start to see these kind of bellicose threatening statements made by certainly former President Bush and even Obama, that starting with Bush, we see that they want Ukraine and Georgia should be, in their words, quote-unquote, part of NATO. Now, in relation also, what do we see going on while NATO is getting ever closer? We see that the congressional-funded NGO, which is short for National Endowment for Democracy, has been working tirelessly to convince Ukraine to join NATO and become an associate part of the EU. But this is all, again, Cold War politics to confront the Soviet Union militarily and to isolate it and to affect what I call regional energy politics and global energy politics for that matter. Now, let us dispel some myths about Russia since the breakup in the early 90s. I think this is most important to say something which seems so obvious to say. Russia is a capitalist country with regional interests, especially in energy exports. This is not a stereotype capitalist versus communist stereotype in the past. Russia has hydrocarbons to sell. And there is no doubt the United States and Europe want greater access and control over Russia's hydrocarbons. Now, even though capitalism has emerged and is developing in Russia, there is still a significant role which the Russian government controls over economic planning and policy making. So my point is this, that Russia can and has exerted some independence over the direction of its economy and over its political affairs. The fact that Russia rejected extraordinary political pressure by the U.S. and EU to turn over Edward Snowden, to me, is one example of Russia exercising some degree of political independence. Now, what the U.S. and Russia are doing prior to and during the unfolding of the Ukrainian crisis is what I call classic divide-and-conquer strategy. What has happened internally is due to U.S. and EU intervention is to support a social base to force the Ukraine and to pressure the Ukraine due to the severe economic downturns to join NATO and the EU. But on the one side, here's what we got. We have seeking one side, which has been kind of mass-produced, supported by the U.S. and the EU, to join with them, but on the other side, and this is the division of Ukraine currently, to have closer ties to Russia. Now, look at what's going on in the present. The results are hardly about the triumph of democracy in Ukraine. For this provisional government in power, in spite of ratification by parliament, violates the constitution, which, by the way, mandates a 75% vote to impeach a president. No such vote was ever held, by the way. Now, with the current head of the government having combined the post of speaker, the position of Speaker of Parliament and President, what you have, and I've mentioned this in my article, is the essence of a concentration of power and the emergence of police state practices in the Ukraine. Now, if there is then an issue after the breakup of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, it is the domination in the Ukraine of an elite political and economic oligarchy. And this is something that the corporate media does not want to go anything near. So while the U.S. and the EU can exploit the well-placed resentment of supposedly people in the streets, the oligarchs and the ultra-right fascist elements, they are using and manufacturing this unrest in the streets to draw the Ukraine ever closer towards the U.S. and the Europeans. Now, what I find certainly troubling politically is that for the first time since World War II, fascists and ultranationalists have achieved positions in the Ukrainian government with the support of the West. And I think your listeners should take note of that. Still, this is just one part of the picture. And again, with the fascists coming perhaps closer to power, and I do not believe they will ever come entirely into power, the issue to me is the politics of oil and gas and how it's being played out and being, pushed under the rug. And that to me is the real issue, the politics of energy, in spite of all this Cold War rhetoric. And that's what I want to kind of turn our attention to and focus to our discussion. And I feel certainly a good place to start to get at that is I urge your listeners to read on a consistent basis, even though they may not feel comfortable doing so, and that is to read the Wall Street Journal. I often read the Wall Street Journal because it gives a very good and honest viewpoint of the ideas and goals of American capitalists.
Andrew, it's the one publication I read daily.
That's good.
I like to cite from it. I like to see what they're reporting, and it's important to realize that the Wall Street Journal writes for the movers and shakers, just like the New York Times. So where they go is to provide them with information, even though it's filled with propaganda. And the Wall Street Journal editorial page is one of the worst I've seen anywhere. It makes wonderful material for me to criticize, Andrew, and I take full advantage of it.
And it certainly outlines honestly, the ideas and goals of the capitalist.
Yes.
Now, I want to talk about some of the recent interesting articles that did appear in the Wall Street Journal. This was just a little over a week ago, and the title read, EU-US to intensify cooperation on energy security concerns, end of quote. Now, this is a very interesting article, and I'll just quickly summarize and move on. The article refers, in essence, to the goal of the U.S. and the EU to support Ukraine so as to decrease its dependence on Russian gas and to work towards diversifying energy supplies. And this, to me, is increasingly the heart of the matter underneath this so-called political crisis between U.S., Russia, and Ukraine. Now, so reading into this article, what you have is that the U.S. support for the coup is related to the global interest by the United States to maintain control over energy resources, that is, fossil fuels. Now, let me point to another related development also appearing in the Wall Street Journal. They reported, which of course the regular media did not report, that the House cleared a package of aid and sanctions as well. And the House votes, I could tell you, by an overwhelming majority, passed a measure combining loan guarantees and expanded sanctions. But yet, this is another indication of U.S. economic interest in the Ukrainian economy. Also, what was reported in the Wall Street Journal was that the IMF agreed to provide $14 billion to the Ukraine as an economic, listen carefully, economic reform program, which requires, quote-unquote, a painful change. That's not so coded language for privatization. Now, always related to this kind of emphasis is what I call U.S. global economic interests getting into the Ukraine and shaping the economy more so to benefit Western and European capitalists is the military. And that's why the role of NATO is all the more prominent as the crisis has continued to unfold. And this has always been typical of U.S. foreign policy past and present, coming down to one or two choices, either to intervene militarily directly, send the troops, or to set up client governments. And that second option is what we see somewhat unfolding in Ukraine. So as a result, what do we see? NATO is increasingly involved in increasing the training of Ukrainian troops, so they're acting as the surrogates for the U.S. military. I find it also no coincidence that a member of the business class, pardon my mispronunciations, first name is Petro, last name Poroshenko, is running for president of the Ukraine. Now, he is an advocate, of course, for stronger ties to the EU and to the United States. Now, but let me get back to what I was mentioning in the Wall Street Journal article and what are the implications are in terms of energy policy and global warming. The underlying ideology behind the military and the economic pressure on Russia, although it's masking as Cold War politics, is really about energy politics, and it's really about how the U.S. can increasingly, as well as EU, shape internal energy policy. But there are other aspects of this economic intervention besides the energy policy, and I'm going to get to that again in a moment. And I do want to make a reference to the extent of what is going on in the Ukrainian economy as an indication. The Ukraine currently exports $20 billion in goods to Europeans in machinery, industrial chemicals annually. And the Ukraine, need I say, is the world's largest grower of corn and wheat, exporting it to the EU. And most of all, for the EU and the U.S., let me get to what I was about to get to. It is gas. It is energy. Now, before the crisis, the Ukraine had relied on the Russian quasi-governmental oil and gas conglomerate known as Gazprom. Now, in November of 2013, Ukraine had signed a $20 billion deal with Chevron to produce natural gas with Ukraine. So this would kind of begin to take the Russian Gazprom out of the loop as a provider of natural gas, and certainly natural gas not just for the Ukraine, but increasingly we start to see efforts to isolate Russia from providing natural gas to Europe as well. Now, as the U.S. and the EU, interestingly, are doing something else which is not discussed and I feel should be linked to the ongoing crisis in Ukraine, is that we see, and I'm sure your listeners are very well aware of this, is the increased extraction of oil and gas through hydraulic fracking. The Ukraine could emerge as an enormous market for the gas produced through this hydraulic fracking. Now, with the current growth of fracking in the United States, the search is ongoing and has not been much talked about, obviously, in the corporate media, is to increase gas exports. And that's quite important. Now, so my point is, if Ukraine and the EU can break away from their reliance on the Russian quasi-government agency, Gazprom, Russia would no longer be a supplier of gas. So this would become what I would call a geographic and economic win for the United States and for the EU as well. Now, again, this is not completely isolated from Cold War politics in the sense that the U.S. has wanted to prove since the start of the Cold War, this is the late 40s, that the U.S. is the only global superpower and the only shaper of geographic global politics.
Andrew, I would add that Russia has the world's largest known gas reserves.
Yes.
Iran that ranks number two. So two Western adversarial countries have the world's largest supply of natural gas, aside from what may be available through fracking.
Yes, precisely, yes. And then there is this, and then there are these other implications. If the EU and Ukraine totally break free from Russian gas and the U.S. and the EU establish deals with Ukraine over gas, well, again, here we have the shaping of global politics through energy policy. Now, also there is this consequence. if there is a severing of the Ukraine from the Russian economy, it would complete what was already started in 2004, what was known as the Orange Revolution, this kind of partial separation of Russia and Ukrainian economies, which the U.S. has been working to do, as well as the EU. I also would suggest a long-term goal is to make Europe dependent on the U.S. for gas and not Russian gas. Now, this is due to the idea that the U.S. has a surplus of natural gas due to fracking, but again, I would caution that this at best is an overly optimistic assessment that this supposed short-term surplus is going to turn into a long-term surplus. But nonetheless, this is what U.S. policymakers in the White House and in Congress are, that is utmost in their minds in terms of energy policy. But it also means that Europe would end dependence on Russian gas. Now, beyond the issue of control over gas, the U.S. and the EU are well aware of what can be gained from control of the Ukrainian economy. Certainly, there are economic assets the U.S. and the EU, multinationals, want to get their hands on. And they can do this by the use of the IMF EU bailout loans. And that can be put in place through direct investment. And in so doing, they exercise control over various segments of the Ukrainian economy. And in support of what I'm saying, I would like to cite just a couple of statistics of another guest on your program and another contributor to your edited work, that is Professor Rasmus. He wrote an article, I quote, "Who Benefits from Ukraine's Economic Crisis?" And he went, I'll only mention a couple things about the article, but he went on to cite those segments of the Ukrainian economy which are of interest to the West, which they want to get control over and, of course, privatize. And he did cite the fact that Ukraine is the sixth largest exporter of aircraft and military goods. He mentioned that Ukraine is fourth in the world in terms of IT professionals. The Ukraine has 30% of the world's richest soils. And finally, he goes on to talk about how well the Ukraine has a educated technical workforce, all of interest to the developed Western world. But again, the point is, through the IMF and various loans, the overall goal is to achieve control over key industries, to privatize them, to downsize them, so as to serve the interests of the multinationals. Now, the possibilities discussed, which, again, I dare not prophesize to what extent they may happen, I'm only making mention of certain trends, but they certainly would not be possible without the support of competing factions of Ukrainian capitalists. I call them crony capitalists. One on the one side, the pro-Russian, and on the other side, the pro-Western. And that's been going on for quite some time now. Now, with the breakup of the Soviet Union and the development of a market economy, these two factions have been vying for control. These millionaires, these billionaires, have been competing to shape Ukrainian economy for their benefit primarily. But the U.S., of course, has been highly supportive of the crony capitalists who are pro-Western in orientation. And that, to me, is certainly what is, in part, the essence of the political crisis. Now, let us mention one particular date, and that is February 22nd. As of February 22nd, the pro-Western crony capitalist coup is now in control. But again, speaking of capitalists inside and outside Russia, there is then the question, which I feel is of utmost importance to address, and certainly I feel as of yet has not been talked about at all in relation to the crisis in Ukraine, is the effect of how U.S. foreign policy is related directly to the politics of energy and of global energy in particular, and dare I say climate change, which I do want to get to. Now, if you had the chance to look at the early March issue of the New York Times, the date I don't recall, I don't have it in front of me, The New York Times had this very interesting headline, and it's and it was, I quote, U.S. hopes boom in natural gas can curb Putin. Very interesting and intriguing and at first puzzling headline. But as I looked at the article, it went on to argue that the U.S., by sending our surplus gas to Europe and Ukraine, the U.S. would in effect diminish the region's reliance on Russian gas, which I believe is the economic bottom line in large part to what's the U.S. and EU interest in Ukraine and in the crisis. But nonetheless, I do must say and caution that certainly in part this is a political fantasy due to the fact that the U.S. nonetheless at the present time lacks the capacity to export gas to Europe, and that Ukraine certainly lacks any kind of technological capacity to receive this kind of gas and to make use of the gas. So who knows? But we're just talking about what intentions are and what our goals are. Still, the U.S. Intention is to send gas exports from the U.S. to international markets and to, of course, the increasingly more profitable Asian markets. Now, still, I want to get back to the headline in the New York Times, again, to ask this question. What could be the possible motive for such a statement, such a headline? And I would like to suggest that policymakers at the top believe that the U.S., with its increased short-term, of course, domestic output of oil and gas through, of course, fracking, can be in a better position to shape global events. But instead, I want to suggest the downside to this, which I feel is the implication, and that is this incredible addiction to oil and gas, which, by the way, even strangely, President Bush in his 2006 State of the Union address spoke of it, is still, and even Obama said as much, is, I would like to say, a indication of how U.S. foreign policy and politics based on fossil fuels is a critical environmental threat to the planet. And that, I feel, is what's at the heart of the crisis. What is going on in terms of the issues of who's going to get their hands on the Ukrainian economy and who's going to have access to gas and oil? Now, let me talk just for a couple moments on what is quite dire by implication of the pursuit of these kind of policies. And I would like to suggest that there are some increasingly troubling indicators of global climactic change underway, and I just want to make mention of just a few quite credible sources of information that are pointing to these disturbing changes. One is the U.S. Information Administration. Their recent report suggested that global emissions will rapidly rise without interruption over the next 25 years. And what the report goes on to say, and it's hardly hyperbole, is that the effect of all this will, in essence, transform the planet into a global hothouse. And this is a paraphrase of the report, of course. Now, keep in mind that with oil and gas as the planet's most profitable commodity and a source of enormous wealth for the petrostates, and you've mentioned a couple of them, Iran, Iraq, there's also Kuwait, Nigeria, Russia, let me see if I have all the names, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, U.S., and the United Arab Emirates. I don't believe I've left anyone off the list. I mentioned Venezuela. Now, for Obama and Putin, they have promoted the energy industry's push to increase domestic oil and gas output, quite dangerous to the global health of the planet. And again, this is what is behind this so-called crisis there in Ukraine. Now, while Obama talks of embracing all forms of energy, if you pay attention to his State of the Union address and other...
Andrew, can I interrupt you a moment?
Sure.
We need to take a break. We're a few minutes over. Hold your thought. We'll take a break, and then we'll come right back and let you pick up.
Sure.
Welcome back. On with Andrew Colin, talking about Ukraine. Andrew, what you're discussing is very important information. Let me let you continue. I'll make one comment. The IMF situation is very, very important. I wrote a couple of articles on it, but I'm not including it in the book because there is good material by Jack Rasmus. Michelle Chosudovsky has material on the IMF situation. I'll just mention one thing, which is so important. The money that the IMF provides, which supposedly will be somewhere between $14 and $18 billion, most of it never even enters Ukraine, except maybe through electronic transfers en route straight to pay bankers. And the amount that does enter Ukraine and stays there has nothing, zero, to do with growing the economy. It has everything to do with paying bureaucrats poverty wages to keep the trains running, etc. That's what the IMF loan is about. And the other side of that coin is strip mining Ukraine of its crown jewels, everything of value sold at cut rate prices, fire sale prices, so Western corporations can come in and literally rape the country. That's what IMF, doing business with the IMF, is all about. But let me let you continue.
Sure, I agree. This money, yes, I cited just a couple statistics, and I didn't focus my attention when I researched the article in my talk on the IMF, but my impression is that yes, it's certainly going to be to massively privatize, and the IMF has already been mapping out what I understand as a partnership with the crony capitalists who are on board to enrich themselves, the 1% as usual, at the expense of the 99%. But again, it's to exploit the resources and certainly to shape energy policy and to have another way for U.S. to maintain its hegemony in various regional areas. So when I look at what comes down to the implications of the Ukrainian crisis, what we see, this confrontation between U.S., EU, and Russia, is about the use and control of energy and about fossil fuels, oil and gas, with obvious dangerous global implications, a few of which I want to get back to. And as I said just prior to the break, what we have with Obama and Putin, both active promoters in spite of sometimes their rhetoric to the contrary, they are promoting energy industries to increase productivity of domestic oil and gas output. And we see certainly, I'm sure your listeners are well aware of this whole business of hydraulic fracking. Now, what we have then is what I would refer to as an enormous environmental fallacy, a folly of such policies. And it's further illustrated by the push to secure approval for the Keystone tar sands pipeline. Now, in spite of the great threat to water supplies and increasing carbon dioxide emissions, the supporters view the pipeline as a symbol of U.S. effort to resist Putin in Ukraine, which is astounding to hear such distorted statements. But this was said by any number of government officials, even former government officials. I came across when I was reading the New York Times about the Keystone pipeline that this kind of thinking was even said by, of all people, the former Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, in a recent, I believe it was in the New York Times, but also in the Washington Post, she wrote an op-ed articulating this preposterous assumption. But again, if you look at the crisis in Ukraine, it's more than U.S. versus Russia in a stereotypic depiction. It's about the root use of what these reliance on these type of energies will have on the global environment and, dare I say, global warming. And I want to say to your listeners, there are some troubling indications currently about where climate change might be leading us. And I must say this, and I find this very, very troubling. A recent Gallup poll surveyed found that only 35% of Americans are concerned about climate change. The Democrats a bit more than Republicans, but not much more than the recent Gallup poll. Now, even if nations halt carbon dioxide emissions immediately, the planet is still going to warm 3 degrees. Now, one might reflexively say, so what's the big deal about 3 degrees? I'll get to that in a moment. But if we continue with our current policies, the estimates are that in 15 to 20 years, we're going to see an average of 7 to 9 degree rise in global temperature. Now, while the idea of climate change might seem like an abstract concept to many Americans, I would dare suggest there are already some concrete effects of climate change being felt. Certainly there are what I would call ominous signs of climate change, which are affecting people on a day-to-day basis. Let me mention what some of those are by making reference to a recent Environmental Protection Agency report. And it's quite clear of what are some of the current, and dare I say what are going to be even worse, future implications if something isn't done about climate change. The EPA report, and again, I'll basically paraphrase it, talks about a variety of dramatic changes in terms of the surface water and groundwater quality. Now, we all know we all need to have drinking water to and to drink and bathe and et cetera. Now, what the EPA report pointed out to is that higher water temperatures and changes in the climate as it tends to warm will dramatically affect water quality. So in other words, the water that we take for granted is of a certain quality is going to be increasingly contaminated. And not only just contaminated with higher temperatures, and again, this is from the EPA report. Your listeners are welcome to look it up. They say especially the higher temperatures in the summer with earlier snow melts and a lot of the snow in many places, including Antarctica, they're predicting in 10 to 20 years will vanish completely. We're going to see dramatic decreases in precipitation, which is going to increase drought. And we're even seeing it in California and other areas in which, again, we're so dependent upon our fruits and vegetables on. Now, in addition, we are seeing because of the dramatic altering of climate in different parts of the country, we're going to see, as we've already gotten a taste of just this past winter and now early spring, the frequency of floods. And this is related also in part to the increased dramatic, and now we're seeing it, of the sea level rising, in particular the salinity of the coastal rivers and bays. Now, this impacts on the purity of drinking water. So when there is flooding, when there is increased salinity of the water, what we are taking in when we drink tap water is increasingly untreated toxic waste, which is now entering into that, you know, system. Now, with the acidification of oceans with this CO2-induced climate change, we're getting a massive loss of marine life. Now, again, we don't see this day-to-day, so it seems innocuous, and why should we concern ourselves? But the point of the matter is that millions upon millions of people depend upon the ocean for food, and that already the EPA is starting to see upturns in increase of starvation due to the decline of fishing stocks. Now, dare I say what the bottom line is becoming in the ocean, if you want to ignore the oceans. The oceans create these tiny little creatures. They're called pyropactins, I believe they're called. And they produce 40% of the Earth's oxygen. Now, they are currently under incredible threat, and their numbers, from what the EPA is pointing to, is dramatically increasing. Now, if you kill off the pyroplankton, which supply close to 50% of the Earth's oxygen, we are facing a threat which could slowly but surely suffocate us, as well as, dare I say, the burning of trees in the Amazon, which is also considered the lungs of the Earth, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess my brief snapshot, you get the picture of what's going on. And again, so the crisis must, I suggest to your listeners, must be also considered in broader terms, broader than just the political crisis, not to say that this is not significant and not that this could, I hope, not lead to a military confrontation between the West and Russia. But the larger question to me is climate change, in that that these two countries and are vying and struggling over the use of fossil fuels, which are endangering the planet.
Oh, do you, Andrew?
Yes.
Still with you. Oh, for a moment I thought we got cut off.
No.
Oh, indeed. So many important issues, and you're into one of them right now.
Yes. So, again, I think if there's an issue in the crisis that should be addressed is that why aren't the United States, the EU, Russia looking for alternatives to use of fossil fuels? Again, it is because it is also a related issue, if I could bring this into the mix, that is the reliance of capitalist economies since the Industrial Revolution to use these kind of fuels to rapidly industrialize and to promote a consumer economy as well. And this is troubling. I would dare say, and sound this is economic heresy in the current climate, but why not? This is something I feel I can say on your program. What certainly economies need is, and many people who know a lot more about it than I have discussed this, is economies of no growth. I mean, these economies are based upon an ever-growing profit margin, and with ever-growing profits is the over-reliance and use of these fuels to produce climate change.
Indeed. Oh, please continue.
Sure. Now, what I would dare suggest then as an alternative is something else, which again sounds like economic heresy, and we know all the stereotype depictions of this as well. And in contrast to capitalist economies, which rely upon growth, I would dare suggest that the solution would be, and I would dare not prophesize, I would just talk in generalities here, would be a socialist economy.
And I would just add that the risks of what is going on now in Ukraine, what began last November, what continued until mid-late February, the 22nd of February, if I remember the exact date, when the coup was sprung and the democratic government was out and the putschists were in power, supported by Washington, supported by rogue EU partners, NATO states, all of them NATO states, literally establishing an American militarized presence, exploited presence, in Ukraine, directly targeting Russia, risking a global confrontation. Literally, the threat of a global confrontation exists. So the threat of global warming is a very serious one, Andrew. That's a long-term process. I would say blowing the world up with a global conflict is an immediate crisis, and that's
yes,
the one that
yes.
obsesses me.
I completely agree. I guess we're kind of juggling two troubling issues here. One, in the sense that this political crisis could become a military crisis, a confrontation. And if you, I was listening to Stephen Cohen, a well-known Russian expert. He was on, I believe, the public PBS. He was quite concerned that this could become something even more past what we, and I find that hard to believe, but I see how he made his point, even worse than the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, I think it is worse.
Yes, that the acceleration of the threat could be such that you could have an armed conflict with NATO forces facing Russian forces militarily. The tensions are quite high in that area. I'm just hoping that there is a diplomatic solution to reduce the tensions. That's what's immediate. What I wanted to certainly raise in addition was the long-term, and it's not so much even long-term anymore, implications of this crisis in terms of fight over resources, in terms of global warming and climate change, which we're starting to feel the pinch of that.
Indeed. So, again, the threats, Andrew, are coming at the entire world that I like to refer to as humanity, literally coming at the entire world from all directions in so many different forms. And the main villain is headquartered in Washington, literally Washington, Obama, the people around him, the neocons that infest Washington, in the Democrat Party as well as the Republican Party. And these are the ones that are literally threatening a potential global conflict. It's the first time in my life that I'm really scared, Andrew. I never was scared during the Cold War. When I was young, I didn't really understand, too young, very young, back in the early 1940s, in the post-war era, 46, 47, I was still pretty much on the young side. I didn't understand too much what was going on, but I never was scared. I remember fire drills in school to protect against a potential nuclear war. But we were young kids. I was in grammar school at the time, in the second grade, in the third grade. Well, kids that young don't know what the heck is going on. They tell you to climb down the fire escape. It was like a game. I remember it like it was yesterday, Andrew. It was like a game. We climbed down the fire escape. We went into the schoolyard behind the school. It was almost like we were going to have fun and games in the schoolyard. Who's worried about a nuclear attack? Let's go play games, and then we can go back to the inside and go back to school.
Yes, it is funny you recall that. I remember growing up also during the Cold War, and we used to have to practice duck and cover in the elementary school. We have to go underneath our desks in case the bomb fell, and we had all these signs for the civil defense, and we had to know that in case the big one drops, the atomic bomb, we would go into our basement of our apartment building, because that somehow would protect us.
There wouldn't be a basement of any apartment building left.
But it is a kind of denial of a kind of scary reality, of almost of what I would call from Kubrick's movie of Dr. Strangelove.
Yes,
it's still a
yes.
Very, very relevant movie that you deny and trivialize certain catastrophes. And let me update it in this kind of, I feel, strange and troubling way. Look at how the media coverage is of this. Very little to nothing. And instead, and I'm not saying this is not a tragedy and a terrible thing, what has the media coverage, for the most part, obsessively been, in spite of its, for a short period of time, there was a little coverage. Now it's over the Flight 370 crash. And that's almost 24-hour coverage of this doomed airline. Instead of saying, let's talk about a very serious, troubling issue, we got to talk about how the search is going.
Oh, indeed. The obsession over that airplane just drives me crazy. You know, the world threatens to go up in flames, Andrew, and the lead story day after day so often is a missing aircraft. You know, it's the top story for the families involved, but it certainly isn't a geopolitical issue unless it's some kind of something nefarious going on that we don't know about it, like a CIA plot or something like that. Until there's evidence whether it could be something like that, we simply don't know. But the obsession drowning out major stories just drives me nuts.
To me, it's a lesson to your listeners. I have to say that they, I'm sure they're aware of this. They need to look for sources like your program and other alternative media if they're really going to find out, because reliance on the corporate media will either misinform or uninform. That's just no place to find out what's going on and what are the underlying motivations behind any policy. They're not going to get it there.
Oh, they're not going to get it here at all. I mean, it's deliberately suppressed to keep people like mushrooms, Andrew, you know, well-watered and in the dark, give them propaganda, give them entertainment, give them bread and circuses, give them sports results, give them everything except what they most need to know. Just drown it out, forget about it. Manage news misinformation. That's about the best way to describe it. Plus the junk food news and all the rest. Outrageous. I think we've got about 2 minutes left, Andrew, so let me let you get in. Any key final thoughts that you want to stress?
Sure. Again, I would urge your listeners, which again, I'm sure they probably do on their own, to search out alternative media sources, to listen to your program, and to not, as best as they can, not to pay too close attention to think that they're getting any information from the corporate media, because the old saying I always tell my students when I teach a media course is what often motivates the media is ratings, and without no advertising, no media. I always say it, no advertising, no media. And what gets on the media is the old saying, if it bleeds, it leads.
Indeed so. And I would add, Andrew, that listeners to this program and ones like it, they absolutely know. They listen to programs like this because they want no part of the rubbish that comes over CNN and Fox and CBS and the BBC and National Public Radio and PBS and Al Jazeera. I mean, these are propagandists. Al Jazeera, owned by the despotic Qatar government.
Yes.
BBC,
yes.
For the last 90 years or so, owned by the British government. You think they're going to give you real news? Not a chance.
Exactly. And again, if you want to understand the media, you have to understand who owns the media. The concentration of the media, especially since the 80s, has been in part led to a undemocratization of media sources of information. Now, look, span this channel. It's the same news. It's the same type of coverage, the same thing.
Oh, absolutely, Andrew. We're just about out of time. I would add that I've mentioned it a couple of times in the past. The media critic, he's long gone now, A.J. Liebling, once said something to the effect that the only people who have a free press are the ones who own one.
Yes. I look forward to being back on your program again.
Oh, Andrew, it was great having you on. I look forward to getting you back again, really. And my great thanks for a marvelous contribution to the
book.
Thank
you.
Oh, I can't wait to get this thing out. I'll just mention quickly in closing, I archive two programs on Thursdays and Friday. They're available in my archives to be listened to at listeners' convenience. And I'm on live every Sunday like today. So indeed, as I like to remind listeners at the end of my programs, make it a regular habit. Tell friends about it. You want real news? You want real information? You want to know what's happening? Well, follow PRN and follow this program with wonderful guests like Andrew Kolin.